everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food here on September 30th, 2014. What's going on with you today? I'm having a great day. Lots of good things happening here at Responsible Eating and Living headquarters where I live, and I hope good things are happening with you. It's my favorite time of the year. It's autumn in New York. And even though it's a little cloudy here, it's pretty lovely. I'm grateful. So, very interesting show today, and I can't wait to get started. So let's get started, shall we? First, we're going to be talking about my favorite subject, delicious food. And we have a very special person with us today, Chef Jason Wyrick. He is the executive chef of The Vegan Taste, a cooking instructor, caterer, a former diabetic, and founder of the world's first vegan food magazine, The Vegan Culinary Experience. He has co-authored the New York Times bestselling book, 21 Day Weight Loss Kickstart with Dr. Neil Barnard, and has taught alongside many medical and dietary professionals. Jason was the first vegan culinary instructor in the world-famous Le Cordon Bleu program through Scottsdale Culinary Institute and has catered for many corporations. Jason has taught hundreds of vegan cooking classes around the world, and his work has been featured in the New York Times, Vegetarian News, and on both local and national television. His website is thevegantaste.com, and we've got him here right now on It's All About Food to talk about his new cookbook, Vegan Tacos. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
How you doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
Good. Any good news over in your home on your end?
Almost. So our daughter is about a week late at this point.
And yeah. She likes where she is right now.
We're on vegan watch.
Well, we're all looking forward to little Gaia when she comes.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, she's going to change the world, make it a more better. I can't believe I just said that. A better place and more delicious than ever.
She's already a food snob.
Really?
Yeah, there are the happy squirmings, and then there are the agitated kicks.
Yeah.
And whenever she smells garlic, she gives the happy squirmings.
What doesn't she like?
Whenever we go out for Ethiopian food, she gets excited.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Hilarious.
Oh, okay. Well, the very best to you with your new baby. When she comes. And let's talk about your other birth, your other new project that came into the world, your cookbook, Vegan Tacos. Now, I have to apologize because when I first heard about this book, and I didn't realize it was your book and I didn't know anything about it, there's a lot of vegan cookbooks out in the world today, and that's a good thing. I wish all cookbooks were vegan and we wouldn't have to put that adjective in front of them.
Yeah.
But there are more and more, and a lot of them are kind of sloppy. They're not very good. The photos are terrible. The food's great all the time because it's vegan, but some of them are not very impressive. And I was thinking vegan tacos, you know, a whole book on tacos, and your cookbook is incredible.
Well, thank you very much.
And you, there's so much to delve into and learn, and it's clear that you know exactly what you're talking about. It's clear that you have an outstanding culinary background, and it's just a pleasure. And it's going to be in my collection one that I go to. I want to reread it when I have a little more time to digest it better because I read it rather quickly. So, thank you.
You're welcome. I appreciate the kind words. That means a lot to me.
Yeah. So we'll talk a little bit about it. You talked about the history of corn and tacos. I thought we might touch on that a little bit. The first time I heard about where corn originated from, it was actually in a book by a genetic engineering scientist, Mendel, and the book's called Mendel in the Kitchen, and this person was talking about corn and how it's evolved over the years from this thing that doesn't look anything like corn to what it is today. And she was trying to explain that all of that change at the genetic level of the corn was a good thing, and that kind of supported her explanation why genetic engineering on food is okay. I didn't quite swallow it. But that was the first time I ever learned about all the things that have gone on with corn, and you talk a little bit about it in your book.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and it's interesting that she used that as a justification for genetic modification, because really, corn's been domesticated for so long, and it has been tweaked very, very slowly by all the cultures that used it, that it really is a GMO, but it's a GMO that's gone through a field test that's about 4,000 years old.
Exactly.
People that are doing GMOs now, they do the modification, then they throw it out to the marketplace, and they're like, well, we hope it works. Thanks.
Yeah, and one of the sad things about the genetic engineering of corn, my understanding, corn and rice and those sorts of grains, is that there have been so many varieties, and now we're losing that diversity.
Yeah, it's really a shame.
Yeah, but anyway, enough of that. Let's celebrate corn and tacos. You also talked about when the hard taco was first invented. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think that's an interesting story because Glenn Bell is the one that really made it popular.
Yeah.
There weren't these hard U-shaped tacos in the world before that on a mass market level. But it was actually a guy in New York. He was a Mexican immigrant who had opened up a restaurant there. And there's a taco called the Taco Dorado, which is, you probably recognize it as a taquito or a flauta or something like that. It's a rolled taco that's deep fried. And his employees hated frying those because they would get spattered with this hot oil all the time. So he created this machine that made these U-shaped hard shell tacos. His employees loved them, but the tacos never caught on there. And then when Glenn Bell was eating tacos, Dorados in California, he thought, how am I going to bring this to a restaurant? And so Glenn Bell actually developed a similar machine, and he's the one that gave the hard shell taco mass market appeal.
And Taco Bell was born.
In an odd way, Taco Bell is not good food, but it is the best food the Mexican food ambassador the world has seen.
Yeah, Taco Bell is not good food, but many of us were introduced to that kind of food from Taco Bell, unfortunately. Fortunately, unfortunately. And my first taco experience, I think, was even worse than Taco Bell in New York. It was with Jack in the Box. And I don't know if you ever had their tacos, but when I was in high school, it was this little plop of highly spiced, ground up to a mush, oily meat, a plop inside of a corn taco, and they were four for a dollar when they were on sale. And I'm just thinking about it makes me sick.
Oh, yeah, I used to live on those, too, because I had a box about 200 yards from my house. So
yeah.
I ate Jack-in-the-Box tacos.
But your tacos are colorful, delicious, fresh. They're full of diversity and so many different kinds. And another thing I wanted to talk about is what I learned in your book, actually, is I knew that tacos, corn tortillas, were typically made from masa harina, but I never knew what gave the masa harina a different flavor from cornmeal.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's from something called nixtamal, which is really just this corn that's gone through a process where it's soaked in lime or ash, because the ash will actually do the same thing. And I think that's how nixtamal was originally created, because there were a lot of foods dating back to a couple thousand years ago that people would cook with ash. And so what that does is it breaks down the hard outer structure of the corn, and it breaks down the cellular structure inside and kind of releases these gummy compounds that allows the corn to stick together. It's pretty incredible that someone figured that out.
It is. There are so many mysteries on this planet, how we got to where we are today.
Yeah.
But I always wondered how it had that different flavor. I kept thinking it must be a different corn variety, but now I understand it's the process.
Yeah.
My first attempt at making a taco was probably in the 80s. There was some sort of like a aluminum taco press that was sold at some of these, not specialty stores. It was more like I'm searching for a word that I can't remember, but it was a funky kind of thing, and I bought it. I thought it was fun, and I had a search for Monster Harina. It was really hard to find at that time. Now, pretty much, I think in most major urban, suburban areas, you can find just about everything.
Yeah, it's amazing. I travel all around the country teaching classes, and anywhere I go, there's a huge Mexican section.
All right, so tacos. Let's just talk about your love of tacos.
For me, they're so versatile. I mean, you can put just about anything into a tortilla, roll it up, and then there's this huge flavor packet that you just put in your hand and you munch down on it, and then you pick up another one and you munch down on it. It's a totally joyful experience.
There are some flavors in the world, the combination of flavors, that I find very irresistible. And the corn, cilantro, lime juice, avocado, tomato combination is just beyond perfection.
It is. I mean, the corn is soulful, and then you have the brightness from that lime juice, and then the creaminess from the avocado. I fall in love with that every time.
Yeah. And we eat a lot of different things here at home, but, you know, the Mexican flavors, I think at least once a week we do them just because it's so easy and we love them. But in your book, there's a lot of other flavors that I'm going to have to start discovering.
Yeah, I think once you start delving into Mexican cuisine, all of a sudden it's like a whole new world opens up to you, because Mexico has been influenced by so many different cultures and taken French cuisine and Middle Eastern cuisine and Italian cuisine and in some cases Chinese cuisine, taken that and used it through kind of a Mexican translator. And it's one of the most diverse cuisines I've ever experienced.
Yeah. Now, you talk about all the different kinds of peppers and chilies and how to prepare them and dry them. You could make your own sauces and seasonings. I know a lot of people rather just buy things, but I always encourage people to find their kitchen and at least try some of these things once, if not more than once. So many of the sauces that are available today in the stores have ingredients in them that we don't really want. And there are a few artisanal products out there, but most of them have too much of not the good things, and it's never the same when you make them yourself.
I agree. I mean, a lot of them are highly processed, and they have these stabilizers in them to keep the product on the shelf for several years, and that, to me, that's pretty unnatural.
Yeah,
they kill the flavor of the food, so they kill a lot of the joy out of eating.
Exactly. And they replace it with sugar, salt, and fat.
Right.
Rather than the good stuff. Okay, can we just hear a little bit more about you and your story, how you came to the vegan world and healthy food?
Well, I used to be, like most people, I grew up eating meat and cheese and the pretty typical American diet. My mom worked and my dad worked, so often my mom would call up and ask us what we wanted from Taco Bell or Jack in the Box, like we talked about earlier, or
yeah,
Burger King or something like that, simply because she didn't have time to feed three boys and didn't know what to do to accommodate all three of us that would make us happy. Of course, sugar, fat, and salt were the answers to that.
Yep.
So that's why we grew up on fast food and a limited number of dishes. And then in college, I had my first really outstanding meal at this Egyptian restaurant. And I was hooked on good food after that. But I was too poor to afford to actually go to that restaurant. So I figured out I need to learn how to make really good food. And I did that. Right after I did that, I went vegetarian.
Mm.
But I was still hooked on fat, sugar, and salt. So what I did was, instead of replacing the meat I was eating with something healthy like mushrooms or broccoli or something like that, I replaced it with a block of cheese. And when I say a block, my lunch was like a pot of beans, a block of cheddar cheese, and Cholula hot sauce.
It's easy.
It's very easy, and it was really tasty. And I got fatter and fatter and fatter until I got up to about 330 pounds.
Hmm.
And then at that point, I was in my mid-20s. I used to be super thin, played basketball in high school, and now I look like Jabba the Hutt with a human head. And I would hide it because I would wear these huge sweaters so no one would know exactly how fat I was.
Hmm.
But at some point, it bit me because I became diabetic. And I got diagnosed with it in an emergency room in Austin, Texas, because I had an infection on the back of my neck that had become life-threatening. And chronic infections are one of those symptoms of diabetes. And this one had just gotten out of hand, and that's when the physician told me what was going on. He was pretty disgusted with me, and I was really ashamed about it. But after being told I'd have to take medication for the rest of my life, and I wasn't even 30, I was like, no way I'm doing that. That's ridiculous. There's got to be another way. And fortunately for me, I had a friend who was also diagnosed with diabetes about a year earlier, and she completely reversed hers by going through the McDougall program, or kind of an approximation of it, because going from eating super rich foods to eating no rich foods at all is really jolting. And so there was a little compromise there, but she had dropped about 60 pounds and cured her type 2 diabetes in less than a year. Then I got diagnosed with it, so I did exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I cut out all the dairy I was eating. I cut down the oil, and then I dropped about 100 pounds. Over the course of about 2 years, it was a little more than that,
mm-hmm.
Than 100 pounds, and I reversed my type 2 diabetes in 8 months.
Nice.
And it was amazing because all the symptoms for it went away in about 3 months. I mean,
yeah.
My eyesight was bad. Now my eyesight's about 2015 again. I was sleeping 10 to 12 hours a day. Now I'm fine on 6 hours of sleep. I mean, it's been a pretty incredible transformation. And that was...
And I bet the food you're eating just got better and better.
It did get better. That's what surprised me. Because before I was making the same thing over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I cut out the dairy 13 years ago, there wasn't a lot of information out there. There wasn't a lot of good food, good vegan food at least. And I was forced to learn how to cook all over again. And by doing that, I ended up exploring cuisines all over the world. And the food just got better and better because of it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did that. For you, for your family, and for all the rest of us who get to benefit. So that's a good story, and I know that there are a lot of people out there listening, and in this country and many other countries who struggle with diabetes, unfortunately. It's very easy to happen. And it's also very easy to turn it around once you make that choice.
I think it is, too. And for me, the key was making sure the food was good, because I read a lot of information where the person presenting the information is trying to treat the physiology of the patient, but they kind of ignore the psychological part.
Mm-hmm.
And good food is what treats the psychology of that, too.
Yeah, that's the psychology of the whole thing is definitely very important. Anyway... So I'm thumbing through this lovely book, and I'm smiling because you have a heading, Taco Heresy, How to Make Wheat Flour Tortillas.
Yes.
And, you know, the wheat flour, and wheat anything is very popular here in the United States and in the Western world, and we try and export those ideas to many people. But, you know, it comes in handy. I remember I was living in France in the early 90s, and I think at some point you mentioned in your history, now that I'm thinking about it, where the French had taken over Mexico for a while and really insulted the Mexican cuisine. And when I was living in France, I didn't see any Mexican cuisine except maybe a box of those, like, El Paso kind of tacos in the box, which are horrible. So I would make my own. And I would make, I would roll my own wheat tortillas, and, you know, it was impossible to find masa harina, so I would just make the wheat flour tortillas, but I had to have them. So much for the taco heresy. And I still think France has a way to go in accepting Mexican cuisine.
I think France is riding on its legacy that it had 150 years ago, which is kind of sad to say, but that's the reason that Mexico had a French influence, was the French were there, and then after that there was an Austrian emperor there, and of course French cuisine was at its height during that period. It was the cuisine to make, and so the emperor brought over all these French chefs, and that's how French cuisine kind of insinuated itself into Mexican cuisine. But I haven't really seen French food evolve to a really high to a higher level than it had before that, whereas a lot of other cuisines in the world have been evolving. And so I think cuisine has fell behind a little bit.
I think it is going to start to evolve because of vegan cuisine.
I think so.
Yeah, I really believe this, and I'm just starting to hear about a variety of a number of different chefs. The one whose name escapes me right now, but very renowned in Paris, and he just decided he's not going vegan, but he's going to only serve vegetarian food and maybe some fish. And people are really angry about this because I guess they want their meat and they want their cheese.
Because French cuisine, country French cuisine, is very veggie heavy.
Very veggie heavy. Yes.
And it was only during that start of the height of French cuisine, I use that in quotes, where they the creamy, heavy cheese stuff really started coming into ascendancy. And I think that's probably been the downfall of French cuisine.
Now, your bio says you're the first vegan culinary instructor at the Le Cordon Bleu program. How did that come about, and what was their how did they embrace you as a vegan in their program?
That was a pretty interesting experience, actually. Yeah, I think that was about 6 years ago. Yeah, I think that was 6 years ago when I was doing that. I was on a local TV station, and the head of the Costa Culinary Institute was there with me, and he saw what I did, and he was impressed. So he asked me to come and be a guest instructor over at Scottsdale Culinary Institute. And it was right when, it was that first week when Le Cordon Bleu had basically franchised out their program. I don't know if it was a franchise, but they basically let other people use the Le Cordon Bleu name and certification and all this other stuff. So I kind of got in at the ground floor of that. So I lucked out in being the first instructor to do that was vegan.
Mm.
When I went there, it was cool because I was teaching the students that were in the last couple of weeks of their program. And so when they do that, they go and they serve food in the restaurants that the school operates. So we created this meal. It was enchiladas in a chili guajillo sauce. It had smoked mushrooms, smoked shallots. It was topped with pine nuts and crispy sage. We did a Mexican-style cannoli with prickly pear fruit and a little vanilla agave drizzle and toasted pine nuts on it. I mean, it was a great dinner, and it outsold anything they had ever sold there before.
Yay, it's all about money. That's how we're going to succeed. We're going to sell out.
That's right. The funny thing was, the students, it was still at a time where vegan wasn't super popular, and so about a third of the students came up to me during the time I was there, and they would look around furtively, make sure no one else was looking, and ask me where they could learn more about vegan cuisine, and they would come up in ones and twos, not knowing that there was a huge interest amongst the other students that were looking for the same information because they thought they would get made fun of and mocked for asking about the cuisine.
Right.
I even had the instructors of the school do that.
That's great. Well, that gives me really hopeful feelings when I hear things like that.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay, well, let's just quickly scan through your cookbook in the last few minutes. I wanted to say, the way you prepare seitan, how did you come up with that?
I was just looking for some more umami flavors to put into it, and I wanted it to not be as tough as seitan usually is, so that was it. I just looked and I thought, black beans have that umami flavor. They're the right color. They're going to make a more tender texture to it. And then everything else was just a way to add in more and more flavor to the seitan.
Okay, I think most people listening know what seitan is. It's gluten, and gluten is a part of the wheat flour. Wheat's made up of gluten and starch, and I believe it was some... maybe the Chinese that created seitan, like the Buddhist monk somewhere, created these meat analogs from wheat gluten. And then it moved into, you can find it in macrobiotic cooking, and vegans latched onto it because it's called wheat meat, and it's a high-protein food that can be used in place of meat because it has a nice chewy texture. Unfortunately, for those that have celiac disease or gluten issues, this is something that is not for them. But it's usually, sometimes it can be spongy, big chunks spongy and have a weird kind of texture, and then some people kind of figure out how to do it in a way where it's just wonderful, and you pound it like meat.
That's exactly it. And the reason you do it, like you can make these huge loaves or logs or whatever of seitan, which is usually how they're made up, and then they're cut up. But if you pound it flat, it's like getting those flattened strips of steak or something like that, and you can use it exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm. And you have recipes for chorizo. Chorizo is great vegan. It's full of so many spices, and it's all ground up. I remember making chorizo for a cast of actors when I was in a show in California a long time ago, and there were some Mexicans in the show, and one of them gave me the greatest compliment, saying that his grandmother would even like it. But
go ahead.
Yeah, no, chorizo. It's just it's a great food, and why not make it vegan? Nobody knows.
Nobody knows, and I've heard from so many people that the vegan versions are actually better.
Actually better. Hello.
I mean, there are vegan products that are as good as taste wise as the meat products, and then there are some that just blow the traditional meat products away, and Mexican chorizo is one of those.
Yeah, so this is a complete book, everything in it that you'll ever want to imagine when it comes to not just tacos, but Mexican-style cuisine, very flavorful, very creative, great fun reading, and thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, so thanks for joining me on It's All About Food, and all the best to you and your wife and your new daughter.
Thanks, Karen. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for talking with me, and take care. Bye. Okay. I really, really enjoyed this book, so I hope you get a chance to check out Vegan Tacos by Chef Jason Weyrich. Okay, let's take a little break, and then we're going to talk about bugs. Nice bugs, beneficial bugs, bugs that are going to help our food and the planet. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. It's time for It's All About Food, Part 2. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's September 30th, 2014. And now we are going to talk about something I've been wanting to talk about for quite a while, and I'm glad we're finally getting to it. I'm going to bring on my guest, Eric Lee Mader, who is the Pollinator Conservation Program Co-Director at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. In this role, Eric works across the world with farmers and agencies like the USDA and the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization to enhance functional biodiversity in working agricultural lands. His professional background includes previous work as an extension farm educator, commercial beekeeper, and crop consultant for the native seed industry. He's the author of several books, including Attractive Native Pollinators and Farming with Beneficial Insects, and that's what we're going to be talking about now. It's a new book that just came out. Hi, Eric, how are you today?
Very good, Karen. It's great to join you.
Yeah, I'm glad we're finally able to do this. It's been, we've been trying to coordinate something for quite some time, and here we are.
Yeah. Great.
So tell me first, Xerces, am I pronouncing that correctly?
It's close. It's actually the Xerces Society.
Xerces. Okay. What does that mean?
I realize it's a rather unusual name, but the Xerces Society is perhaps the oldest wildlife conservation organization in the United States that most people have never heard of.
Exactly.
We actually take our name from the now extinct Xerces blue butterfly. It was the first butterfly to go extinct in the United States due to human-influenced habitat loss. It was actually a casualty of the Second World War when the last of its habitat in the San Francisco area was paved over to build the Presidio Naval Base for the war effort. And we are actually a 44-year-old organization today. We began as a butterfly conservation group, but have really expanded our focus over time to work on invertebrate animals more broadly, which tend to be the most underrepresented animals in traditional wildlife conservation efforts. So we work on things like freshwater mussels, which are probably the most imperiled group of organisms on Earth today. We still do some butterfly conservation work. We do work with amazing creatures like migratory dragonflies. And then we have our pollinator conservation program, the program that I co-direct, which is really our largest program area and works primarily in agricultural lands as sort of a framework for bringing farmers, which are, you know, incredibly dependent on pollinators and on bees for pollination, to bring them to the table and get them engaged in conservation.
Well, I've read your book, Farming with Native Beneficial Insects, and I really enjoyed it. And it's what I love about it is your solutions are not only beneficial because they're going to help us make a more sustainable world, reducing pesticides and herbicides and helping farmers yield better products. But the solutions are beautiful, stunningly beautiful.
They are beautiful, yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned the new book. So Farming with Native Beneficial Insects actually represents a bit of a departure for the pollinator conservation program because it's really an effort on our part to now look at this concept of conservation biological control, which is the sort of the strategies around which we manipulate landscapes to bring in predatory and parasitoid insects that prey upon crop pests and reduce, in some cases, can eliminate the need for insecticides. It's a form of natural pest control. And as you say, you know, the actual on-the-ground implementation of these strategies is beautiful. It typically involves creating native wildflower meadows and field borders or native shrub hedgerows that support broader biodiversity, support songbirds, hummingbirds. It's a more holistic approach to agriculture, and it's really an attempt to blur the lines between agriculture and ecology in a very much science-based way. It's sort of a combination of landscape architecture and agriculture. The pragmatic results are beautiful, and the aesthetic results are certainly stunning to look at.
Well, I love when solutions are a win-win all around, and Farming with Native Beneficial Insects sounds like that to me. Now, I think a lot of our problems started or became more intensified right after World War II. Chemical companies were done making destructive war chemicals and were figuring out what they could do with them, and they turned into pesticides and killing bugs. And people applauded them for enabling us to grow more and yield more. And farmers started to go away from 100-year-old techniques of rotating fields in order to get efficiency, more efficiency. I hate the word efficiency these days because we don't look at all the costs of efficiency. And now we're struggling because of it. Everything's damaged. The soil's damaged. We have droughts, and the food isn't as good. And we're killing the bugs that can help us.
Yeah, and really, you know, we're running out of options. So
we're running out of options.
With this strategy of insecticide or chemical-based pest control, you know, it's inevitable that pest resistance to insecticides evolve. And we see this with every class of insecticides in use, both historically and today, that resistance evolves, you know, in a given time frame, and in some cases a very quick time frame. And that's sort of built into the pesticide industry business model to be constantly creating new products. And it's interesting that there's a, you know, there's a natural life cycle of chemicals in the marketplace where pest resistance typically evolves within roughly the same time frame that pesticides go off patent and become available for other chemical companies to mimic. So there are these dual incentives to constantly be creating new classes of insecticides. And, you know, we certainly know the sort of historical track record of insecticides and their role in you know, sustaining or harming global biodiversity. I will just point out today, and you know, I'm much more of a technical guy. I like to be talking about, you know, the bees and the beneficial insects and how you actually do this on the farm than I do than I am comfortable talking about the policy. But I will just point out today that there is an incredible assessment of global wildlife biodiversity that came out through a published report from, I believe, the London Zoological Society today, that calculates, based upon current models of wildlife stability, wildlife population stability, that all wildlife groups are disappearing at probably twice the rate we originally suspected.
Mm-hmm.
And this is across taxa. You know, it includes mammals, it includes fishes, it includes birds. At the base of all of these food webs, both terrestrial and aquatic, are invertebrates, you know, the bugs, the mollusks, the crustaceans. These are the food base for all other animals on Earth. And probably the most significant threat to those animals, along with habitat loss, is pesticide use.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So we could have a domino effect.
We are having a domino effect. Yeah.
And your society has some really outstanding solutions. And let's just talk a little bit about the different bugs. Now, most of us don't know much about bugs, and bugs creep us out.
Sure.
And all of these solutions that you have are not just for big farms. They're also for gardeners.
Correct, yeah. And at the base of all of these strategies and all of these recommendations is an understanding that beneficial insects, whether we're talking about lacewings that feed upon aphids or whether we're talking about bees that will pollinate blueberries or pumpkins, whether we're talking about lady beetles that might be eating thrips or spider mites in your garden or on your farm. These animals all typically need some form of alternative food throughout the year. Typically, they depend upon pollen or nectar to sustain them when prey insects are not available. So planting wildflowers or intercropping wildflowers with agricultural crops can provide those beneficial insects, whether they're bees or whether they're predators of a pest, can provide them with food that can sustain them throughout the growing season. And it's especially beneficial to focus on truly locally native wildflowers as opposed to introduced wildflowers. Beneficial insects that we have in our gardens and our farms co-evolved with locally native plants. Whereas pest insects, many of them are not native to North America. They tend to thrive in relationships to non-native plant species, including crops, but also non-native wildflowers. So by really creating farms or gardens that seamlessly blend areas of native natural plant habitat with crops, you create these corridors for these beneficial insects to move throughout the farms and gardens and to sustain them throughout the year. And at the same time, you help deprive pest insects of refugia, of places where they can lay eggs or overwinter and maintain populations that you may not want. That's really, I mean, it's amazingly sort of simple as a principle, and many people are sort of taken aback at that simplicity, but it truly is that simple, and it's scalable. So we work with my organization, the Xerces Society, works with everybody from backyard gardeners who are doing this to people growing thousands of acres of small grains or oilseed crops or almonds. And at every level, you can integrate these principles, integrate native natural plant habitat into a crop system.
I love it so much. I was just like smiling on every page of this book. Is there a time when a beneficial insect can become a pest, or vice versa, where a pest can be beneficial? Does it depend on the locale, or once you're good, and once you're bad, you're bad?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a specific example of this. And probably, unfortunately, the best examples I have are of human-introduced, quote, beneficial insects, biological controls, basically, for specific pests. In the case of the United States, there have been efforts by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to introduce parasitic wasps of the gypsy moth. And, of course, the gypsy moth is an introduced pest, highly detrimental pest to the eastern hardwood forests of the United States, especially a huge defoliator of forests. And there have been these attempts to introduce these parasitoid wasps to prey upon them. And they go back to, you know, the locations where the gypsy moth was, where it evolved, where it's native to, and they brought its parasite to the United States from those areas. Well, you know, the effectiveness of those parasitic wasps on gypsy moth pests has been debatable. Hmm. One thing that isn't as debatable is the fact that we have seen these parasitic wasps having a broader appetite range than what we originally thought they would. So they've also have, in some cases, attacked native species of wild silk moths. And there's some really beautiful, really fairly uncommon and unique native silk moths of North America that are now even less common because we've introduced this, you know, supposedly beneficial insect for another pest that has further reduced their populations. So, you know, I think with these introduced beneficials, we do tend to run into more complex issues of ecology and pests versus beneficial and having to evaluate the costs and benefits of that. With our native species, typically not the case that we see something that is a beneficial insect sort of becoming a pest in different contexts. And I should say that I sort of hesitate, although I do it constantly, I use the term beneficial insect, but I sort of hesitate to use that intuitively, just knowing that really the vast majority of insect species on Earth, probably 99.9% of the hundreds of thousands of insect species on Earth, are truly either beneficial to us or are totally benign. The very, very small number that spread diseases or prey upon beneficial insects or prey upon plants that we depend upon.
Yeah, I don't know much about bugs, but I want to think that that's true. And we're very good at labeling things with negative labels. We have names for weeds, and for some people, weeds are nutritious plants. And,
sure.
And pests, you know, maybe if we didn't create an environment where these bugs thrive and destroy so much, they wouldn't be a pest.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And again, these are intuitive concepts. So the things we typically think of as pests are pests in monoculture crop systems, because those are the only insects that those monoculture crop systems can sustain. If you've got a more diversified land base with different types of crops, unrelated crops, and these native flowering plants integrated into it, suddenly the food web becomes infinitely more complex, and you really create a landscape where pest populations struggle to reach a economically damaging threshold.
Now, I think people, the bugs people know most about are the bees. We hear a lot about the loss of bee population and these new neonicotinoids that are killing them. And what I keep reading in your book is this creation of all of these wonderful grasses and wildlife and wildflowers around the crop fields give such a lush environment for bees and other beneficial insects to thrive.
Yeah. And in fact, we see, and I work with these farmers. I work with farmers all over the U.S. who are able to integrate habitat like this into the farms. And, you know, their dependence on, say, managed honeybees for crop pollination can go away. They can literally substitute habitat for rental honeybee hives for crop pollination. You add the habitat, you support a wild-based population of native wild pollinating bees, and your crop can be entirely pollinated by that, assuming you have the scale of habitat necessary to support that crop. And the same is true with pest control.
Now, my understanding is that a lot of these large farms, agribusiness, bring bee colonies in to pollinate. And if they had an environment like you're suggesting, would they not need to do that? The pollinators would be right there and stay there?
Correct. Yeah. Wow. And there's amazing research around this now, research from New Jersey, research going on in the University of California system, research at Michigan State University that is routinely and repeatedly demonstrating that, you know, farms that have a sufficient amount of habitat on them do not need to bring in rental honeybee hives for pollination. They can get all of their pollination met exclusively from the landscape alone, from the wild bees that are supported by that landscape. And this works obviously very intuitively on a small scale. I think everybody kind of gets that, yeah, you know, it makes sense that a small farm or a large garden could do that. But in fact, this does work on a really large scale as well. I'm calling from Canada here today. And it's amazing research that's been done in Western Canada looking at canola pollination. And canola is something that does benefit from bee pollination. Amazingly, here in Western Canada, large-scale growers can make more money. They can produce more canola seeds in the absence of honeybees if they take 30% or more of the farm out of crop production and leave it as wild natural habitat. It's counterintuitive that you take land out of production and you actually increase yields, but in fact that's the case, and that is the case specifically because these natural areas sustain wild pollinators that can increase the yields of canola on the remaining amount of land.
That's really exciting. So I'm wondering, why aren't all conventional farmers jumping on the bandwagon and doing this? I understand that the initial investment of time and money is big or maybe inhibiting, but over the long term, it's really a win.
It is, yeah. And the question you're posing is one that a lot of people are posing. And it's really, you know, it's a sociological question, much more than an agronomic question. You know, there are people looking at that question finally. So we are, my colleagues at the Xerces Society are working with researchers at Michigan State University to manage a now nationwide project called the project is called Integrated Crop Pollination, where we're looking at different aspects of the puzzle, right? How we can add habitat to farms, how we can improve conditions for managed bees like honeybees or mason bees that people may be keeping for crop pollination. But we've also brought in the sociologists to look at this question of why adoption is relatively slow. That said, there are some amazing farmers in the United States who are adopting this. And my organization has offices in New Jersey, in Texas, in North Carolina, in Nebraska, in Minnesota, in California, in Oregon. And we work with farmers literally in all 50 states now who are doing this, who are adding habitat to their farms for natural pest management and for pollination, and are having great success with it.
I guess we need to have some kind of critical mass.
Yeah, I think we have had in recent years here in the past 4 or 5 years, we have had farmers plant at least 160,000 acres of wildflowers on their farms to support these insects. So it is happening. It certainly needs to happen faster. But
yeah,
we're seeing gains now in this concept that we've never seen before in modern history.
Okay, so we have a couple of minutes left, and could we just touch on the drought, like in California? Are there scenarios that you can propose that would actually work well with the drought and kind of reduce some of the risks and symptoms?
It's hard from, you know, purely a crop productivity standpoint. My work has sort of limited overlap with the drought, but I will say this, that we have amazing work, amazing habitat restoration work going on in California right now to support pollinators and beneficial insects. We have an almond orchard that is hundreds of acres in size that is adding miles, literally miles of native shrub hedgerows to the farm to support these unsung insect heroes. Those hedgerows are made up of native California plant species that are truly drought tolerant. So these habitat systems and conservation systems are built for the weather and climate conditions that we have. They're built for, you know, hundreds or thousands of years in the landscape, and they are built to withstand these tough drought conditions and sustain biodiversity in the middle of that drought. So agriculture may, I think it's sustainability in a drought context is maybe a big question mark, but these natural areas for beneficial insects are there for the duration.
Eric, thank you. This is very exciting work. Thank you for caring about the invertebrates.
Thank you, Karen.
Yeah, and you can find out more at xerces.org. That's xerces.org.
All right. Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, that's the end of this show. Bye-bye. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Wasn't that fun and interesting? Let me know at info@realmeals.org. I love to hear from you. And remember, have a delicious week. Make some vegan tacos. Bye-bye.